From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Washington Watch. Coming up, the world in which we live is filled with political and social volatility. While the instability and change is not unique to our time, history does not provide many parallels in terms of the intensity of the instability and the change that's taking place. Oftentimes, the instability leads to greater repression, often taking the form of restrictions of religious freedom, freedom of speech. However, there are examples where this instability is leading to potentially positive developments right now in our time, in large part because of the leadership of the current administration. For instance, the people of Sudan, after three decades, have risen up and thrown off the dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, and there's now a reformed government that's taken its place. In fact, I met recently with the new prime minister, Prime Minister Hamdok, and members of his cabinet. Now, with the recent developments in Iraq, with an uprising of the public and the announced resignation of the prime minister, an opportunity to shift the political landscape may exist there as well. Now, the ancestral homeland of some of the earliest Christian communities, you know, the people have fled in the wake of the terror of ISIS, and most have yet to return to their homeland. Their presence is critical to the long-term stability and revitalization of this region. They provide diversity. Now, what is the current situation in Iraq? What are the possibilities of a way forward? What can America do? And what will it mean in the larger context of the Middle East if Christians and other religious minorities can return to Iraq and even into Syria? We're going to explore those topics today in this special edition of Washington Watch. I'll be joined in just a moment by Congressman Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska. We'll also talk to Brandon Wheeler, Executive Director of the Freedom Research Foundation. He has operated in the region since 2005, working with the legitimate political and military leaders of the region. And then General Jerry Boykin will weigh in on the military/security importance of reestablishing the Christian and other religious minority communities. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at TPerkins. Well, Congressman Jeff Fortenberry represents Nebraska's 1st Congressional District. He is a member of the House Appropriations Committee. He also serves as the ranking member on the House Agriculture Subcommittee and is a member of the State and Foreign Operations Subcommittee. I have worked very closely with Congressman Fortenberry on a number of key issues as it pertains to religious freedom, and I mentioned pro-life issues as well, but he is the leading voice in the Congress for the Christians and other religious minorities in Iraq and that region of the world, and he joins us now. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, always a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm so grateful for the leadership you provide of elevating America's conscience around fundamental issues that ultimately matter, the essential things, the higher things. And I listened to your introduction and really grateful for it, because you could ask the question in the opposite as well. What if the Middle East loses all of its religious minorities? I watched with horror as ISIS swept across large swaths of Iraq and began a genocide against Christians and Yazidis and certain Muslim population. I happen to represent the largest Yazidi population in America. These were young men, frankly, who came to America because we gave them citizenship because they were our translators at the height of the Iraq War and earned special immigrant visas. Many settled, interestingly, in Nebraska, and that community is friends of mine. It's an ancient faith tradition that's been present in northern Iraq as well. But without the presence of these minorities, as you rightly said, you lose the opportunity for diversity. You will have a default back to just tribal and ethnic allegiance. When you have a pluralistic character of a nation, of course, it teaches tolerance and mutual understanding. And the Christian population has brought many, many benefits to the larger population in terms of education and health care and service to Muslim brothers and sisters as well. So everyone who has a mind of goodwill or a heart of goodwill and a mind of reason recognizes it, particularly in Iraq, that it is essential that these communities be rebuilt and retain their rightful place as a part of this diverse mosaic, this tapestry of religious minorities who have contributed so wonderfully through history to the healthy nation state of Iraq. If you lose that, Iraq has no chance at a healthy nationalism. You will have more out-migration and pressure on for migration. The Yazidi community has 400,000 people trapped in working refugee camps in the north. That will put additional pressures on the government of both Kurdistan as well as central government in Iraq. And, of course, we have a militia movement largely underwritten by Iran, which is operative in the northern part of that country as well. So there's multiple reasons to be very concerned about this from a humanitarian perspective, from a perspective of rebuilding Iraq, and from a perspective of the larger geopolitics of the Middle East. And I get it. I think it's important to say this. America has given so much and we've lost so much in Iraq. It's hard to understand why more needs to be done. But yet with a very, very light initiative with other multinational partners, we've got some solutions working in Congress here that I think could be where we could help restore the ancient religious minority tradition there.
And I want to talk about that because you have the one legislative proposal that is in process. But shortly after the election, the administration turned some attention to this area. And I'm not talking about – we're not talking about a military solution. We're talking about a solution that involves security as a part of it, but it's not necessarily us putting military on the ground there. But shortly after the administration, and they tried to get some stuff done over there, you went over to Iraq at the request of the vice president, spent some time there in country, talking to, meeting with leaders, religious and political leaders. We're now at a point where it looks like there's a unique opportunity to get something done. You've been working on this now for months. Let's talk about the legislative initiative that you have.
Well, again, thank you for teeing that up. We've actually been working on it for years. And again, I get it. It is very hard for us to stare the realities of Iraq in the face, given America's past commitment and where we are now. However, this is one chapter left that we have to write. When the vice president, at his behest, I went to Iraq along with the Sam Brownback, who served as our ambassador for international religious freedom, my former neighbor in Kansas, former governor of Kansas, and Mark Green, who is the administrator of the United States Agency for International Development. We went at the behest of the vice president to evaluate the situation. Now, one thing very positive that we have done in Congress is shift considerable amount of economic aid to help the beleaguered minority communities rebuild. And that's been very important. And we went to evaluate the possibility of that success. And it is possible. We can help rebuild these communities. The situation is urgent. And one unleft piece of work that needs to be done is security. So you're right. This doesn't necessarily involve larger American troop commitments or boots on the ground, so to speak. But it would. My proposal actually calls for the integration of Christian and Yazidis and again, certain Muslim minority communities into the central government of Iraq's security forces. Because you remember what happened in the north. The Christian community, the Yazidis, were overrun by ISIS. There was mass confusion. They couldn't protect themselves. There was no mechanism by which they could do that. People were just showing up in the middle of the night in Erbil, in Kurdistan, sleeping in parks. Nobody had any idea what was going on. It was just mass confusion. And, of course, thousands of innocent people were killed, were murdered. And of course, we still have probably still in the thousands women being held by ISIS that were in sex slavery, one of whom is Nadia Murad, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, who's a Yazidi. So there's unfinished business there in terms of security. And if we can, through a multinational contingent, set up a training mission for counterterrorism to help integrate religious minorities into the security forces, they will be empowered, I think, to take better control of that area, create stability, and this economic aid can actually be leveraged multiple times. It ultimately does come down to that. If people can't be secure, they're not going to take the chance of going back, and they need to go back because these are their lands and Iraq needs them.
Yeah. We recently, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, I chaired a hearing on Iraq, and that was The two top issues that were repeated by those who appeared before our commission in terms of why people are not returning to their homelands, their communities, is A, security, B, economic opportunity. And you're not going to get economic opportunity until you take care of A, the security. Goes back to the militias, and I think you're right, to get the indigenous people from those communities integrated into the security forces is the key to providing that local security.
Yeah, so it is a simple idea, a very light footprint of leadership from America in concert with other partners around the world. We've had conversations with numerous governments, and many have expressed interest in doing this because, again, it is a positive thing, a training mission, using Iraqi indigenous people, the beleaguered people who are victims of genocide, to empower them to actually protect themselves. I think it's the right move. We've gotten this resolution through the Foreign Affairs Committee on the House side. I seem to be stuck with it in terms of its passing the House. I continue to work it very aggressively. And frankly, Tony, you mentioned that I've been working on this for months. Actually, it's been much longer. So there's just not been a good alignment of creative forces to make this possibility real. So it's very helpful to me, honestly, that you're talking about it. The State Department is interested in the idea. The White House has expressed interest. We just need to align everyone to get this across the finish line because, again, I think it is an unwritten chapter, maybe could be the final chapter, of America's more intimate involvement in Iraq. I just think it's the right thing to do.
Well, no question, as you mentioned earlier, we have invested a lot in Iraq, and it would be a shame not to preserve and build upon the foundation that was laid with blood, sweat, and tears. And this is quite frankly, I think this is a moment in time with the changes that are taking there, the kind of organic uprising that's taking place there among the people of Iraq that want freedom. And we see them crossing religious lines and ethnic lines to stand together, which is unique. This is not something being forced upon them from the outside. It's coming up from within.
Yes, and this is really an amazing moment if it can be if it can mature and ripen around, again, what I call a healthy nationalism. This movement is largely the Shia people demanding a different outcome in terms of the relationship of Iraq with Iran. They're proximate countries. They fought wars. There's holy sites where people travel back and forth. And, of course, we're all very much aware of Iran's intention of continuing to put it nicely, have a presence in Iraq or meddle in their affairs. So it's interesting how this movement against those dynamics is coming from people who would traditionally be aligned religiously. So what that says is, again, Iraq has the potential for a restoration of a healthy nationalism. By the way, I'm reading a book. It was written in 1932, and this is just to show you the example. It was written by a Jesuit priest who founded a college in Baghdad that existed until Saddam's time, and it was a very pluralistic society, even in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing historical reality.
Congressman Jeff Fortberry, I want to thank you for joining us. We're up against a break, but thank you for the work you're doing on behalf of the Christians and other religious minorities in that region, and we join with you in moving toward a solution for that region of the world. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony, for your good work.
All right, thanks so much. Congressman Jeff Fortberry of Nebraska. To find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. Don't go away. More to come on the other side of the break.
A strong case can now be made that China has become one of the most totalitarian states in human history. The Chinese Communist Party restricts religious practice and oppresses religious minorities on a sweeping scale, targeting those of every faith, especially Christians, Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, and Falun Gong. The Chinese Communist Party's movement against religion has had and continues to have devastating consequences for those who simply wish to live according to their conscience. The Chinese Communist Party's consistent abuses of human rights prove that it cannot be treated just like any other country. The United States must address these human rights and religious freedom violations in their trade and diplomatic dealings with China. For more information about the human rights crisis in China, visit frc.org/China. That's frc.org/China.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a 2-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home.
In the U.S., the rate of chemical abortions is at an all-time high. This rapid increase is being driven by the abortion industry, which wants abortion pills available through the pharmacy in the mail, making do-it-yourself abortions the future of the abortion industry. Abortion advocates once claimed that legal abortion would prevent back-alley abortions, but now they want to place the burden of inducing abortions completely on women, despite the fact that the health complications that often result from an induced chemical abortion are eerily similar to those of back-alley abortions. They include severe bleeding, infection, retained fetal parts, the need for emergency surgery, and even death. With all the documented dangers of abortion drugs, it is clear that the abortion industry's goals are political, ideological, and financial, not the well-being of women. For more information about the dangers of chemical abortions, visit frc.org/chemicalabortion. That's frc.org/chemicalabortion.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you joining us for a special edition of Washington Watch. Not often we take a program and dive deeply into a particular topic, but this is one we've been talking about a lot. The Middle East, we've been talking about Syria, Iraq, and the reason is because there are pockets over there. And of course, this region, as I mentioned at the top of the program, you go back to some of these communities in northern Iraq, Syria, some of those go back to the very beginning of the Christian religion. These communities were their longest living communities, Christian communities, up until ISIS and the other turmoil in that region. But the folks aren't coming back, even though there is some element, at least in Iraq, of peace. They're not coming back, and it's essential that they do. So how's that going to happen? What's the current landscape culturally, politically, from a security standpoint, and what does it mean for the future of the Middle East? We're going to be talking about those issues today. Join me now to talk about the landscape, what's currently happening in northern Iraq and northeast Syria, is Brandon Wheeler. He's the executive director of the Freedom Research Foundation. He has operated in the region since 2005, working with legitimate political and military leaders that are indigenous to the region. Brandon, welcome to Washington Watch.
Tony, thank you for having me. And I'd like to first thank you so much for being what I see as a leader for the moral soul of the American people. And we need you here. And I know as a former service member, it's people like you that make this country worth fighting for.
Well, thank you, Brandon. And Semper Fi. former Marine. Marine veteran, I should say. Let's talk about, you just were in the region. You're operating there kind of, it's where you're headquartered at. There's a unique opportunity here with Iraq. We've had the announcement of the resignation of the prime minister. We've seen these what appear to be grassroots demonstrations, some of it pushing back on Iranian influence on Iraq. Describe the moment that we're in and the opportunity that's there and what's actually happening on the ground.
Absolutely. I think that there's just a natural process of governance that the people of any country have to go through certain challenges to see the value of freedom. And when we first went into Iraq, the Iraqi people came out of a dark period of the Ba'athist regime of Saddam Hussein and didn't really understand what freedom meant. It was foreign to them. And you can see, if you even look into American history, you know, the Battle of Gettysburg, we lost 50,000 Americans on both sides. And I think we as Americans learned a lot about what is required in order to have freedom as a right, but also as a responsibility, a God-given right, but a responsibility. And what you're seeing in Baghdad right now is that the Iraqi people having to deal with, you know, America leaving Iraq, good or bad or indifferent, and the creation of ISIS was then the influence of Iran becoming much more grand and much more direct, to the point where the Iraqi people no longer had a country. They were simply tools of the Iranian regime, and they've had enough of it. And so to see them grow and identify that they as individuals have been given the inalienable right of from God to run their own country have now been supported by a coalition of Sunni Arab tribal leaders and political leaders, Christians, Yazidis, and influential financial backers, as well as intellectual leaders, where 9 districts in Baghdad have at points had up to 1 million protesters in the streets, and the militias in Baghdad have killed almost 1,000 people using guns and explosives, kidnappings, murders. So this, as I described in a previous meeting, there is no going back. There is no reestablishment of the government. The government in Baghdad is unquestionably lost the consent of the governed. And in our declaration, it is stated very clearly that when the people lose the consent of the governed, they have the God-given right to alter or abolish the government that they have. And that's what we're seeing the Iraqi people doing. And it is a unifying thing. As you know, people have said that the a healthy nationalism is what we're seeing the Iraqi people come together and do and demonstrate it in the street with civil disobedience and stepping up for what they want to see as the future of Iraq.
Now, Brandon, we juxtapose where we are today in Iraq, where the events in Iraq today compared to when the United States went into Iraq. The difference is, these are folks that want the change themselves. They're looking to do the changing. There was a vacuum created. Iran was a part of filling that vacuum, especially when the United States pulled out. The solution here is not the same as it was a decade ago. It looks like everything is in place. It's just a matter of giving some guidance, redirecting some things, and we could see a restoration of really freedom for the first time in a long time in the northern part of Iraq.
There's no question, and I believe wholeheartedly that this president of the United States is the only one during my lifetime which has the will and the ability to execute such a plan, and I hope that he does. There's no more troops, no more money required, and we're capable of being able to identify very specific detail as to what the Iraqi people need at a minimum in order to retain control of their government.
This change that's taking place, it is actually done within the context of the Constitution that the United States did help them set up when they set up their new government. So this is kind of following the process that's there.
That's true, and there are certain other steps for decentralization and giving other ethnic minorities a future of governance. You know, what a lot of people don't understand is that countries like Iraq and Syria, they have a central government, but they do not have a decentralized state system.
Right.
So this would unfold into creating the first states within these countries.
All right. We're up against the break. I want you to stick around, if you will, Brandon, because when we come back, I want to talk about the implications that what's unfolding right now as we speak in Iraq, the implication that has for Syria, northeast Syria, something that's been focused on, especially by Christians here in the United States in the last couple of months because of what Turkey has done. Talk about how this might affect those religious minorities as well.
My pleasure. Looking forward to it.
All right, folks, don't go away. We're going to continue our conversation with Brandon Wheeler, Executive Director of the Freedom Research Foundation, about what's happening in Iraq and Syria. and what America needs to do going forward. That's next. Don't go away. What other trips to Israel can you take that combines walking where Jesus walked with meeting today's Israeli leaders? This is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, inviting you to spend an incredible and life-changing 9 days in Israel with me, General Jerry Boykin, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann from June the 2nd through the 12th. We'll stand in the ancient ruins of synagogues where Jesus preached, worship on the Sea of Galilee, walk the streets of Jerusalem, stand on the Mount of Olives, and have communion at the Garden Tomb. You'll meet Israeli leaders who will share about Israel's intelligence and defense systems and brief you on foreign policy. As one of our former travelers said, quote, the worship, spiritual, and geopolitical understanding that FRC contributes to the trip makes it an experience not to be missed. So join us June the 2nd through the 12th for this unique experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Can a Facebook post or a tweet or an Instagram picture change a person's mind? At Family Research Council's 15th annual Pro-LifeCon Digital Action Summit, pro-life activists from around the country will gather to explore the impact that digital media has on the culture's view of human life. Join us via live webcast from Washington, D.C., the morning of Friday, January 24th. At this year's conference, you will hear from political leaders, bloggers, journalists, and activists who will share how they view social media and other digital tools to further the pro-life message. You'll be educated and empowered to better reach your own communities by learning best practices from those who are at the cutting edge of the digital pro-life movement. With this innovative information, anyone can make an impact for the pro-life movement. Anytime, anywhere. Tune in Friday, January 24th at 8 a.m. at ProLifeCon.com. Again, visit ProLifeCon.com for more information.
Listening to Washington Watch, I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us for this special edition of Washington Watch, going a little deeper today. And one of the topics we've talked about frequently, that is what's happening in the Middle East as it pertains to Iraq and Syria. You know, some people say, why do you focus on those foreign policy issues? Well, first off, we're talking about religious minorities, including Christians, who have been driven from that region, which creates greater instability. And if we can get that right, bringing back stability and causing the pieces to come into place where there's economic vitality, it's less of a problem for America. But we also have a responsibility to our neighbors. And who is your neighbor? Well, I think they're our neighbor. Joining me in studio here, Brandon Wheeler, Executive Director of the Freedom Research Foundation. Brandon, we were talking about Iraq. I want to talk about how Iraq influences Syria if we get it right there, given the moment in time that we have.
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to understand that for 20 years, America has been focusing at the symptoms of the problems and ill-defining the nature of the threat. So at Freedom Research Foundation, we have developed a concept or a strategy that we break into three parts in order to defeat what we say is a threat: define, delegitimize, and defeat. We've heard terms like terrorism, extremism, radicalism, and unfortunately, those do not well define the threat so that we can understand what we have to do in order to defeat it. And what the threat is Islamic fascism. So if we understand that war is politics by other means, what is the nature of the ideas that somebody picks up a gun in order to use violence to implement? And if you make that definition of Islamic fascism as opposed to, say, terrorism, which the Obama administration did, then you can't try to make a deal with Iran, which is one of the number one state supporters of terrorism, and be fighting ISIS and think you're solving the problem. You're just doing different things on different ends of the problem. If you look at Islamic fascism as a definition, it makes no distinction between ISIS, Iran, Hezbollah, the Hashd-e-Shaabi, the Iranian-backed Iraqi militia, ISIS, you know, al-Nusra Front. All of them are different. They have different nomenclatures, distinctions. But what they want to achieve is the same thing, which is the use of Islam as a set of conservative values implemented by force to control and to rule people. And so That is the definition.
Let me just stop you there for a minute. Why are we misdefining it?
We're misdefining it because we're relying on news commentators and media people who don't understand what's actually going on the ground, and they don't experience it. You know, when I talk to leaders on the ground, both political and military, they use the term fascism. I add the term Islamic because I want to make a distinction between the fascism of, you know, the World War II period. So until you experience it and you see what's actually happening on the ground, it just looks like some really bad thing with bad people and guns somewhere far away, when the reality is they're creating governments and they're ruling. I mean, ISIS was making license plates, currencies. They had a governor. I mean, they were a government for all intents and purposes.
Is there a fear to defining it because it's not politically correct?
Absolutely. I mean, countering violent extremism is the most ridiculous term I've ever heard in my life. And so by not – you know, we're not villainizing Islam. You don't have to do that. And we can't be successful without the partner of Muslims in the region. There's no question. And I've trained Muslims in Afghanistan, in other places. I work with them every single day. And really, there has been a distinction in the last couple of years. You know, I've been there for almost 15 years now, more. And the there's been a distinction that now – you know, because of how brutal and disgusting ISIS was, that a lot of Muslims want to make a very clean line in the ground as to what they stand for and what their values and how they're different than ISIS. Whereas before, it was a little blurrier when I first started operating in the Middle East. So I don't want to say ISIS is a blessing of any kind, but I think that what it did was it forced people to define who they were as Muslims.
I absolutely agree with that. I think people said, wait a minute, that's a Muslim. I'm not one. And it's what we saw in northeast Syria that brought together Yazidis, Christians, Muslims coming together basically for joint security, for one, just to protect one another from ISIS. And so in the wake of ISIS, there's this unique opportunity. That's why we were so discouraged by Turkey moving into Syria, into that northeast region where this autonomous government was working, religious freedom existed. And so I want to see if we can get this correct in Iraq, is that going to influence what's happening in Syria?
There's no question. So this isn't being able to create governing structures where people value individual freedom rights, multilinguistic, multi-religious things is not something you can force people to do. It has to be organic from the region. And we've defined and found those places in northern Syria and Iraq. And I want to make a comment about Turkey because I think it's important. We are misunderstanding who Erdogan is and the Turkey under the Erdogan regime. He is an Islamic fascist. He is the real leader of the caliphate. He's using Arab refugees and weaponizing them against people who share our values, the Kurds, the Christians, and the Arabs of northern Syria to occupy lands and to kill thousands and to make them leave and displace. So understanding who Turkey is under Erdogan, and I don't hold that against the Turkic people. There's many good people in Turkey who are not happy with the rule of Erdogan either. But we have to define and we have to be honest with ourselves about who Erdogan is and what Turkey is under his rule.
Right. It's very volatile. But I do think, and we're going to talk about this next with General Boykin, I think if we can get this political structure right in northeast Syria and in northern Iraq, that it provides a kind of a checkmate to Turkey and to Iran.
And that's the second part of the defined, delegitimized defeat. Building those governing structures based on values and creating real governments where people have freedom is the only way to defeat this threat.
All right, Brandon Wheeler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tony.
All right, folks, to find out more about Brandon, go to the website, tonyperkins.com. Don't go away, because when we come back, we're going to be joined by Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin. We're going to talk about the implications for security in that region of the world if we get this right. That's next. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come. Ever hear the term toxic masculinity? Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council. Masculinity is under attack in our culture. The American Psychological Association released guidelines declaring traditional masculinity ideology as harmful. Brown University, an Ivy League school, offered a course, Unlearning Toxic Masculinity, explaining that rigid definitions of masculinity are toxic to men's health. And a University of Texas class, Masculine UT, treated masculinity as if it were a mental health crisis. Thankfully, the culture does not have the last word on true masculinity. God does. Our Stand Courageous Men's Conferences offer biblical solutions to the crisis of manhood. We seek to help men develop character, cultivate habits, build relationships, and make commitments that will move them closer to God's design. Check out StandCourageous.com for an event in your area. That's StandCourageous.com.
Do you know of one person who knows absolutely everything? No? Me neither. And so, if we don't know everything, we all need to be lectured sometimes. Or at least, we all could benefit from tuning into a lecture now and then. Well, Family Research Council has just the thing. A new weekly podcast called Lecture Me, created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast podium features today's top thinkers who take on tough issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stick around after each lecture as we break down the content and discuss these topics further. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council and host of Washington Watch. I invite you to join our family and thousands of others across the country in standing on the Word of God as we go into 2020, the global year of the Bible, by joining in a 2-year family chronological Bible reading plan. I can assure you that your family will be powerfully impacted by reading God's Word and growing in the understanding of His truth together. The readings take only 15 to 20 minutes a day, with Sundays set aside for a family or small group discussion. To join us, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and click on Stand on the Word with FRC. That's TonyPerkins.com, or call 800-225-4008. That's 800-225-4008. Let's stand together on the Word of God and change the world, beginning in our own home. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. And by the way, as we approach the end of the year, the battle for America's future is far from over. Let me just ask you, as we approach 2020, will you partner with FRC so that we can continue to make a difference together in 2020? And by the way, as you give before December 31st, your gift will be doubled thanks to a generous year-end challenge match. So everything that you give will be doubled. So help us advance faith, family, and freedom for the sake of America and America's future. Go to TonyPerkins.com to partner with us. All right, we've been talking about Iraq and Syria in this special edition of Washington Watch. We're going to continue with General Jerry Boykin, retired lieutenant general, 36 and a half years United States Army. Last post was at the Pentagon. He is now the executive vice president here at the Family Research Council, and he joins me now in studio. General, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. It's good to be here.
All right. I want to go back for a moment to when the United States went into Iraq originally. And because you were in the military then.
Right.
You were a part of were you at the Pentagon at that point?
I was not, but I came to the Pentagon about 3 months into it and became the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence.
Let's talk about, kind of going back to lay the foundation of why we are where we are as it pertains to Iraq and where we need to go and some potential solutions here.
Yeah, Tony, when we went in, sadly, the United States really did not have a good grasp on the Middle East. They didn't understand the tribal structures of the Middle East. They didn't understand the complexities of relationships in the Middle East. And what we did is we went into a nation there that was 60% Shia, but it was controlled by a 20% minority because of Saddam Hussein. Now, he was an evil despot, but he controlled the entire country with only 20% of the people being aligned with him tribally. And then ultimately, we helped them write a constitution, Tony, that started with the Islamic Republic of Iraq. Once we did that, we were legitimizing Sharia. We were legitimizing Islamic law as the foundations of this new nation that was being created here with a constitution of its own.
Now, let me go back. Pre-9/11, our focus was not heavily upon the Middle East. We were looking elsewhere in terms of threats to the United States and such. And I would also argue, and I argue this back during the Bush administration, in the kind of nation-building mentality that we had, that you know, our State Department and our government, predominantly driven by a secular Western mindset, failed to understand that these folks in the Middle East, like you know, 82% of the population of the world, actually believes their religious text and lives according to that religious text.
No, that's exactly right. And keep in mind that, you know, these people have they haven't educated the majority of the women in those countries. So the women can't read and write. Therefore, all they get in terms of religious training is what is given to them by men for the most part. And the men have every ambition to control the women there. So you've got at least half the population there that can't even read the, you know, the what they consider to be their holy book. And then when you tell them that Sharia calls for the beheading of a woman that's accused of adultery, or the stoning a woman that has been accused of being out without you know, somebody in her family escorting her, they have no choice but to believe this.
Right.
This is the way things are in Sharia, because they can't even read the Quran. And that has been a deliberate thing. Keep them in the dark so you can control them. And what we did was legitimize that by legitimizing Sharia.
And I think we're in to some degree, and I'm a little more involved with this now in my role at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I'm afraid that part of our policy is disproportionately focused on the religious leaders there in Iraq, which is only fostering kind of the mentality of a theocracy there, as opposed to giving voice to the political leaders. Now, sometimes they're one and the same, but increasingly what we're seeing happening right now with the protests and the pushing back is an organic opposition building up against that theocratic structure.
It is, and keep in mind that 60% of the people are Shia. That means that at least theologically they have some alignment with the mullahs of Iran.
Right.
Because those mullahs are considered to be the, you know, the highest order within Shia Islam. And they just happen to be in Qom, Iran. And Iran has for centuries wanted to dominate Iraq.
And they're moving in even now.
And they're moving in to do just that. And these Shia militias that have been there ever since the U.S. precipitously
right.
pulled out of Iraq
right.
with no real plan for what we're going to do afterwards. These Shia militias have been a major problem. They're the ones that have killed Kurds.
Right.
They've killed Christians. They've killed Yazidis. And they've given rise to a lot of violence there.
And as we've talked about, those militias in large part are the reason so many religious minorities have not come back into their communities, because it's still not safe. And as you say, there's this connection to Iran with
right.
these militias, which ironically, they're being funded through Baghdad, and Baghdad is being funded by the United States. It's just, quite frankly, it's kind of crazy. But there's an opening here.
Yeah.
Unlike when we went into Iraq the first time, this time, the call for freedom, for throwing off this repressive government or ineffective, corrupt government, because we just had one of the government officials leave the country with untold amount of money to go to England. This is being driven from the grassroots. It's organic. So the question is, what can the United States do? And we've talked about this previous in the program, and I know that our answer is not military necessarily. It's just supporting the right people and directing the funds in the right way. So what's the path forward here to potentially provide a firewall around communities, religious minorities in the Nineveh Plains, and even, you know, this I think could be an example to back up and strengthen what's happening in northeast Syria, and be a checkmate to Turkey's advancement and even to Iran.
Yeah. First of all, I think if we go back to the Bush administration, there was a team that went over there to come back with a recommendation about how to deal with the future of Iraq, and they came back with a plan to divide it into three areas: Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish. I think they've got to go revisit that plan. Mm-hmm. I think that America's got to use all our elements of national power that we can to help prop up a legitimate government there and to do all we can to stop the corruption. Now, that's a big task for America, you know, because corruption is just a way of life. But the people are recognizing it. They're not accepting it, and they're saying enough is enough.
It's different this time.
It's different this time. They're saying enough is enough, and they're rising up right now wanting to overthrow what they consider an illegitimate government.
But let me play devil's advocate for just a moment and ask you this question. Why is this our problem? Why, given all that the United States has already done over there, the lives, the dollars, why should we continue to be involved?
Well, I think we have an obligation to continue to be involved. You said it's not a military solution, and I agree with you. And we don't have that much military over there right now anyhow. And I think that that's got to be relooked. But in terms of helping to solve the problem there, I think that it is the U.S. does have responsibilities, because we need to remember that we have one democracy in that part of the world, and that's Israel. And this is on the border of Israel. Keep in mind, this is on the border. I mean, this is, you know, Jordan sits between, a very small strip sits between Israel and Iraq. And Iraq has been a problem before. If you go back historically, Iraq was unified when they came and attacked Israel. Go all the way back to the, you know, to 67 and the 73 wars. And you find out that Iraq was one of the threats against Israel. So we have that's one of our obligations, is to defend our allies Israel. And they are, again, they're the only democracy in that part of the world. But I think the second thing is that any kind of instability in that part of the world is ultimately going to target Christians. And we have just a moral obligation to help our fellow Christians. And you're working that pretty doggone hard. So should we put more troops in there, and should we try to re-engage in day-to-day combat? No, I'm not saying that at all. But I think using our economic power, using our diplomatic power, using our intelligence power, those are all elements of national power, and we can use all of those to help and make a difference in there to reduce the threat to our allies in Israel, as well as to the Christians in that part of the world.
I mean, it almost appears that there's a second wave of the Arab Spring. Lebanon, we just saw what—
Different this time, though.
It's different, but also if the response of the United States is different, because we have a different administration this time. We had an administration last time that was apathetic or ambivalent at best toward what was happening there, and the outcome was deadly. Of course, we saw what happened in Egypt there with Muslim Brotherhood and elsewhere. So I think the appropriate response, by coming along behind those who are seeking greater freedom, and we're already seeing this in Iraq, where religious minorities are being incorporated in the Muslim community is working with them, those that are seeking freedom to throw off this government. So there is something very similar that happened in northeast Syria, where when you have a common enemy, you come together and you form alliances, which can be the foundation for greater freedom and democracy going forward.
No, and that is a model for the way things should be in that part of the world. Sadly, that's the only place that that exists. In fact, the only place in the Middle East that you know that has ever existed up until the point that they formed this coalition government in northeast Syria was in Israel.
Right.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, you've got Christians, you got Jews, you got Muslims, you've got all kinds of people living together in relative harmony. Now, you also have on their borders, you know, in Judea and Samaria, you got some pretty bad actors, and in Gaza Strip, you got some pretty bad actors too. But the people that live as Israeli citizens inside the territory that we know as modern-day Israel, they live in relative harmony.
Let's go back, and before we run out of time, a potential solution as – and we touched on this, but for instance, in the Nineveh Plains where a lot of these religious minorities and Christians live, they're seeking kind of a carve-out of – and this is actually allowed for in the constitution there in Iraq where they would have their own governing province. Mm-hmm. And this goes back historically to this region. It's tribal. Prior to World War I, this area was a lot of nomads, tribal lands. Right. This nation-state concept that is a Western concept that was imposed there has shown to be problematic. And the only way they keep it in line, generally speaking, is with tyrants and dictators. So is that not a potential solution, allowing these areas of division within the country so you've mm-hmm. got kind of people that are like-minded, generally focused in the same area, coming together and developing their own governments?
Yes, and we need to keep in mind that for the most part it was the Brits that actually drew lines on a map that created these countries that we know today, okay? So you question the legitimacy of that just because it was, you know, there's no historical.
Right.
Yeah, there's no historical regions in most cases, like Saudi Arabia, for example, and the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. You know, that was land that was given to the Hashemite king that was actually given by the League of Nations to be a future state for Israel, a future homeland for the Jews. So all of this stuff is sort of illegitimate anyhow. And I think it's possible to divide this now as the Bush plan called for. And I think we could, we can't do any worse than it's already doing over there.
Well, certainly something we need to be watching in the year 2020. In fact, I think as things are so rapidly unfolding over there, movement is going to take place very quickly. Whatever is going to happen over there is going to be decided shortly. So the United States needs to be weighing into this. Okay. General, thanks so much for joining us. As always, great to have you on the program. And let me, I don't know if I'll be the first, but I'll be close to it. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
And I'll see you next year.
I guess so.
All right. Well, folks, thank you for joining us. And visit the website, TonyPerkins.com. Lots of resources there for you and opportunity for you to partner with the Family Research Council. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.